Good afternoon, good morning, and to those of you who are up in the middle of the night in Europe, I hope that you got a little sleep and that the dawn is coming in a beautiful way. So it's really a pleasure to be with you for one more class. It seemed that for many of us, it wasn't quite time to end our satsang, and I definitely felt that way. One reason being that we hadn't actually finished the text. And because the Parasthiabhigna Hridayam is a text that ends with liberation, it seemed to me that it was important that we actually get there in the course of this class. I do think that for those of you who are real text geeks, this class just opened the door. In other words, there's a lot of geekery that we can do around the Sanskrit text itself, especially Kshemaraja's commentaries. We managed to look very deeply at some of the sutras and some of the words. Some of the sutras, there are two I'm thinking of particularly that I would have loved to delve into more deeply, but in terms of the arc that we are following and the length of the class, we weren't able to do it. But I honestly, I want to promise you that we will be tuning into these particular issues and teachings that are characteristic of non-dual Shaiva Tantra, non-dual Shaiva Shakta Tantra, in many different ways over the next period of time. So I also will give you questions to work with in this week to come. Questions you can work with your partners, some particularly significant passages from the last two sutras, so that you can go even deeper if you so choose. And today we're going to take the text to its conclusion and hopefully answer some of the questions that have come up to say something about how we take the teaching forward. And of course we'll meditate together. So let's begin now with just taking a couple of moments to settle our posture. Those of us who are seated, see if you can find the triangle that we spoke about last week that Hira sent us such a great kind of redrawn diagram of from an anatomy book. So find the pubic bone in the front of the body. And if it helps, just find it with your finger. And find the sitz bones, which are the two protuberances that actually stick out and that we're told in pretty much all posture instructions. You know, we're supposed to sit on the sitz bones, not on the coccyx. Because if we allow our posture to put weight on the coccyx, it actually risks crunching the spine and crunching the coccyx itself. So the sitz bones are there for a purpose, and the triangle formed by the pubic bone and the two sitz bones actually is the, I would say that we could fairly say that it is the anatomical, structural equivalent of the home of Kundalini Shakti, which is, of course, in the subtle body, but in a place in the subtle body that pretty much corresponds to this triangle, as above, so below, as here, so elsewhere, in the subtle body, so in the physical body. As you find the alignment of the crown with the center of this triangle, you might move forward and backward, side to side, circle around a little bit and find it. Inhale and feel the breath moving down towards the lower body, and exhaling, feel that it moves up and floats the crown upward. Let the shoulder blades release onto the back. Let the chest open. Find your chant sheets if you need them. And we're going to chant our opening invocatory mantras, and then we're going to meditate.
Namah Shivaya Satatam Pancha Kritya Vidhayini Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne Namah Shivaya Satatam Pancha Kritya Vidhayini Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne Namah Shivaya Satatam Pancha Kritya Vidhayini Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne. Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durgakshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durgakshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durgakshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durgakshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadha Namostute
And for the next moment or two, just let yourself bring your attention to the breath. And let's bring our awareness into the center of the chest. I'm going to ask you, those of you who feel comfortable doing this, to take your right hand and place it over the breastbone with the palm more or less in that hollow place that actually it's between the two nipples in a man. It's between the two nipples in anybody, actually. Just put your palm over that place and use that as an anchor. Begin to connect the breath with the mantra Sauha, inhaling with the feeling that the mantra flows in as though through the center of the chest. And with the exhalation, see if you can just allow the breath in the mantra to interiorize your consciousness, to bring you into the heart. For some of you, it's very helpful to visualize the heart center. You can visualize it as a flower, a lotus, as the classical tradition says. You can visualize in the heart center a sun, which is one I like. You can visualize it as a cave, a beautiful, velvety, dark cave behind the breastbone, beneath the breastbone. And just allow the breath to flow in as though through a softening in the chest wall. And with the exhalation, see if you can feel that space of the inner heart expanding, just gently opening a bit. Now with the next exhalation, feel that the breath and the mantra Soha rise up from the heart through the center of the throat, through the center of the head, and up to the space above the crown, the space 12 finger widths or 8 inches above the head. So the breath flows in through the heart, into the heart. And then with the exhalation, it flows upward and comes to rest above the crown. And then the breath flows in as though it were flowing in from above the head, flows down towards the heart with the mantra Soha. And then with the exhalation, it flows back up from the heart, through the throat, through the center of the head, coming to rest in the Sahasrara, the upper Dvadashanta. The mantra Soha flows with the inhalation and exhalation very softly and gently. If you like, you can visualize a lotus or a sun in the heart. And you might also want to visualize a sun in the upper Dvadashanta. Little by little, as the breath flows in from above and down to the heart through the center of the body, as it flows up from the heart to the center above the crown, the mantra Soha, which is one of the mystic mantras of the lineage of self-recognition, flows very gently like a sigh with the breath. See if you can nestle your awareness more and more deeply into this channel between the heart and the crown. Now ask yourself, what is it that's aware that I'm meditating? And without, again, waiting for a verbal answer, just see if you can focus into the open space that arises in answer to that question. And with the next inhalation, let your attention follow the breath into the heart and rest there. We're going to be going in and out of different ways to unfold the mudra during this practice, during this evening. And I want to just make a couple of general points about meditation. One of the sharings that came in this week on the listserv was from someone who had been wondering how to focus on the heart. And he had come across a description of the heart as a lotus and discovered that if he imagined a lotus in the heart, that this helped him find the heart. I thought this was very beautiful, and I was very happy that he shared it, because it points to something very important. One thing I've learned as a meditation teacher over the years is that the dictum meditation is not one size fits all. I think I made it up, actually. But the idea that meditation is not one size fits all has just showed me again and again and again how important it is to know this. For example, breath focus, the kinesthetic experience of turning to the breath, being mindful of the breath, is maybe the core practice in every meditation tradition. And yet, I know many people who have a problem working when they meditate with the breath because of physical difficulties in getting the breath or psychological issues, so that's not the practice for them, at least not in the beginning. The same is true of mantra, which in the tantric tradition, and certainly in my own experience, is one of the most profoundly transformative practices there is. Yet many people don't relate to mantra, find it to be a kind of an unnatural add-on, or haven't found a mantra that kindles the flame for them. And again, inner body practices like tuning into the heart or the dantian or the central channel actually can be quite demanding if we don't have a clearly active interoceptive awareness. And for many of us in our very intellectually centered society, tuning into our brain's capacity for feeling inside the body takes practice and takes time. And similarly, self-inquiry, the awareness of awareness practice, can feel revelatory, or it can feel like a form of dissociation. So really depends on your own natural energy, your own natural predilections. And of course, there are many people who don't feel like they're good at visualization because they can't summon a perfect picture of the heart lotus or the goddess. So one of the things that I try to do in giving meditation instructions, and for all of you meditation teachers, yoga teachers out there, I know that this is probably true for you too, is I try to cue people so that at least three of these modes is mentioned. You know, in other words, to try to give a kinesthetic breath focus, a visual focus, a mantric or sonic focus on the theory, which Kshema Raja also mentions in Sutra 18, that one of these practices will catch you. And at the same time, I believe that there's value in not being sure you know how to do a particular practice. For one thing, if you're willing to experiment from a position of, I don't know if this is going to be something I can do, but I'm willing to try it, you might find that if you reword an instruction or actually ask yourself, okay, how can I make this work for myself, that by being willing to work with the practice without either getting scared because it feels opaque for you or trying to follow the instructions exactly when they're kind of going against the grain of your energy, when you start to question how to make a practice alive for yourself, what will happen is that you can start to activate what I call the inner meditation coach. And again, those of you who practiced a lot know that we all have an inner meditation coach who is a very different entity than the inner judge, the inner critic, the inner destroyer of your meditation, of your confidence in meditation. It's not that voice, and it's not the voice of your distraction, the one who says, maybe this isn't working. Maybe I should do this other mantra instead of the one I started with. That voice. The inner coach is the intuition that goes, okay, try it like this, or kind of gives you the nudge to let go of the mantra at a certain point as you start to turn inside, or tells you maybe if you can stay sitting for another few minutes, this opening that you're experiencing will go deeper, or just simply tunes you into the awareness that knows you're having the experience. The inner coach doesn't always show up as words, often as a feeling or a kind of an energetic nudge, but can also show up as the voice of the teaching. I know for me, having studied these texts a lot, there are certain experiences, certain moments in meditation when the teaching will arise because the teaching describes something that I'm experiencing. Activating the inner meditation coach is hugely important, and one of the things I love about this Sangam is the way in which so many of you are sharing the wisdom of your inner meditation coach with the rest of us, sharing, first of all, the authenticity of your experience, your willingness to be vulnerable, and the creativity and basically insight that so many people bring to the listserv, along with being able to be helpful in the way you speak to someone's question without being preachy. Sometimes I've been joking during this class that this course is an excuse for you guys to get together around a text, and I think that's fantastic. It's one of the most beautiful things about our global, viral, virtual satsang. So last week, as you know, or actually 2 weeks ago, we did a short tour through Chapter 18 of the Pratyabhijñādhyāyam, which offers a powerful series of fairly advanced and sometimes esoteric practices for expanding the hidden madhya, that subtle inner space that is masked by thoughts and activities, by the flow of the breath, but which is always to be found at the beginning and end of every activity, and that also exists in the central channel, the Sushumna, and in the different chakras, in the space above the head, the space behind the body. So inside the madhya is what Deepak Chopra, in one of my really favorite ones of his catchy phrases, he calls it the field of all possibilities. It's the formless source within which everything can get resolved, including your traumas, if you know how to offer them into the formless spaciousness. And it's also the source of creativity. Someone wrote me about how to use these practices to bring forth your creativity. The madhya is really the doorway into that. And in the madhya, we can learn to float down the river of presence into the realms beyond maya, actually, to float deeper into pure presence until we actually float past our limitations. The madhya can open to that space where we realize that there is both emptiness of all form, and yet from within that place forms arise. Because Chitti Shakti is so fully present in the madhya, when we fall into that space and when it emerges, we actually experience pulsation. We experience aliveness. We often experience blissfulness. And that blissfulness can be very light, very subtle, more a form of strong contentment, or it can be actual real-life ecstasy. And I want to say that when you enter into the spaciousness that the tantric traditions call the madhya, the center, the core of consciousness, it's not empty. It's formless, but it's not empty. And the tantric sages kind of dismiss what the Buddhists call shunya or emptiness as mere void. And what they mean and what they're talking about here is that in the space of the madhya, there is always the experience of Shakti, of her tremoring, of her aliveness, of her quality of blissfulness. So the spacious center that emerges and that we expand, as Sutra 17 says, is actually a space of Shakti. It's this place where the Shiva and Shakti aspects of awareness are both present, and in which their tendency is to reveal the powerfully alive nature of your own space of consciousness. Now, the practices in Chapter 18 are, as you probably discovered, fairly advanced. And one of the secrets for doing these practices, which I am really seriously recommending that you continue with, find the ones you connect to, but also experiment with some that you don't quite connect to. The secret for working with practices like this, you know, with the kind of abstract, formless practices, is to do it in short bursts. And this is, again, kind of a classical, standard way of practicing with awareness of awareness, for example. In one of the Tibetan traditions that works very directly with awareness of awareness, it's emphasized that when we first start meditating on awareness, and often for quite a while afterwards, the feeling of having touched it or entered it lasts for, you know, maybe 10 seconds or 30 seconds or a minute, and then we're back in thinking. What most of us experience is that we go in and out of contact with awareness of awareness, whether, you know, especially once we start activating it, we can go in and out of contact with it many, many times over the course of a formal meditation session. And then there will be moments when awareness expands, the madhya expands, and we're inside it. But at the same time, once you've, as I like to say, cracked the code, once you can have a felt sense of what awareness itself feels like, we find is that we can actually tune into it over and over again throughout the day for 10 seconds or 30 seconds or 60 seconds. And it becomes really a way of tuning into our core over and over and over again over the course of the day. And we can do the same with the space at the end of the exhalation, or we can center ourselves in the heart, as we talked about last week, or tune into the sushumna. We spoke about this last week or last class, but since these are the core open-eyed practices that the Pratyabhijñādhyayam offers us, they can very easily become coordinated with our daily life. They can help us stay centered, and they can help wake us up as we go through the day. So, you know, there are certain meditation and self-help practices that we do for the sake of centering and healing and just feeling better. These actually fall into that category. There are also practices that we do for the sake of waking ourselves up in the course of a day, and these practices do that as well. And, you know, just as the dissolving samskaras practice has had a lot of resonance for many of you, so powerful for self-healing and even for trauma work, you know, once we've gotten past the initial stages, that this practice of dipping into awareness or centering ourselves inside, practicing Shakti Vikasa, Vikasha by, you know, letting our senses be open while keeping our attention inward, it will start shifting our ego contraction. And it will also, again, as many of you know, greatly expand our spiritual and personal power, our ability to leapfrog over our limitations. So in terms of where or when to, when and where to do these kinds of practices, I normally take them up once I've settled in meditation. And if you've studied with me a lot, you know I always say this, but I find it really, really good to start with a concentrative anava upaya type meditation practice like mantra or chanting or visualization or mindfulness, and then stay with it until my attention has actually turned inside. As it settles, as my attention settles, which, as you know, as we all know, takes more or less time depending on how busy you are in the rest of your day. But as your attention settles, you can start to become quiet enough to sense what we call presence, you know, this kind of felt sense of interior energy. And then we can actually find ourselves entering the madhya, especially if we have cultivated madhya meditation. So the more you cultivate presence and the more you, let's say, walk yourself up to the door of the madhya, whether by meditating in the central channel, as we've just been doing, or by following the breath and tuning into the space between one phase of the breath and the next, the more you begin to discover what the madhya really is, and that means the more you begin to shift into open spaciousness. This text, as you've probably figured out, can accompany you through pretty much every stage of your journey. It has something to say to you that you'll feel and find on a deeper level as you get more and more open to it, essentially, as you become more aligned with the teachings of non-duality, as you become more comfortable experimenting with your own consciousness. One reason, I believe, why the Pratyabhijna Hridayam is such a powerful text is because it's not only a pointing out instruction about what this universe really is and what your awareness really is. It also has a devotional element, even though he doesn't front load the devotion. You can actually see it in the invocational verses and some of the wordings in his commentaries. The non-dualists in this tradition, Abhinava and Kshema Raja and Utpaladeva, were devotees of goddess, devotees of Shiva, devotees of Kali, and they understood divine forms. The way the tattva chart that we looked at in the second week of the class describes them, in other words, the great deities, the great famous deities of the Indian tradition and other traditions, I would say probably, though this is probably including the God of the Old Testament, the God of the Quran, their personal forms of the formless that exist at different levels of the tattvas beyond Maya. And they're a little bit closer to us than the formless transcendent state of pure Shiva Shakti. But they hold within themselves the non-dual awareness, the capacity that these deity forms are, I'm trying to find the right word for this because I don't want to make it sound too anthropomorphic, but essentially they are beings whose consciousness is completely in the experience that whatever exists and doesn't exist is inside them. So in other words, they are personal forms of the transcendent absolute. And as we know, the great thing about personal forms of deity is that we can have a relationship with them. We can tune into goddess in a form if that's what we want to do. It's not a requirement, but it's available, as it were, while at the same time realizing that what we call goddess or what we call God is not a form, or is a divine intelligence whose unique freedom and power enable her to express herself by creating infinite worlds and living within them. So I think that to have a, you know, a truly transformative relationship with what we call the higher power or supreme consciousness or absolute reality, we need to know that this reality is so much bigger than this, that it can contain whatever happens on the physical plane and all the planes in between the physical and the transcendent. But we also need, most of us need a kind of a big daddy and big mama. At least I have found that I do many times, because as human beings, we are relational creatures, and there are just times in our practice when we need to have a conversation with or to take refuge in the ultimate divine parent, who, unlike our own parents, you know, who were human beings, loves us completely unconditionally and actually can protect us. Maybe not in the sense that nothing bad will ever happen to us again on the physical world, because, of course, what happens to us is, in many respects, a matter of karmas, but can protect us against the feeling that we're limited, alone in the universe, and that there's no way out of this trap that limits us to the body. So the recognition path is one of the purest and most non-dual, perhaps the most non-dual of all the tantric traditions, because it leaves nothing out. In other words, it makes space for the possibility of personal relationship with deity and of also realizing that any form dissolves ultimately into formlessness. It also makes space for working with our pain, working with our suffering, and even finding doorways through our suffering into our core, into our center. So it really, this teaching really is a powerful basis for any practice you follow. We're going to segue into Sutra 19. I really didn't want to leave you without this sutra because it is such a powerful practice for integrating inner awareness with the open-eyed state, and it is in many ways a restatement of one of the practices in Sutra 18, Shukti Sankocha Vikasha, in which we learn how to replicate the activity of Shakti as she moves out of her indrawn state and manifests worlds through our senses. So here's the Sanskrit. Samadhi samskaravati vyutane bhuyo bhuyas chid aik yamarshan nityodita samadhi labaha. Forgive my pronunciation. When emerging slowly from deep meditation, while still feeling its residue, contemplate the oneness of whatever is perceived with chitti. Practicing this again and again, you will attain a meditation that continuously arises. Looking at some of the words in this sutra, which is an interesting thing to do here, especially because they're actually very much words that describe felt states that arise in our practice. So the word samadhi means that your subtle intellect, your own consciousness, has become immersed in your own center, the spaciousness of the madhya. The word vyutana, which literally means rising up or getting up, refers to this state of transitional consciousness that occurs as we come out of deep meditation. This transition, which is the slightly mazy, misty experience that, you know, you've been sitting, alarm goes off, or your time is up, or there's just a natural coming out of indrawn awareness. And then there's this little moment when you're still half in meditation. You're awake, you're feeling your body usually, but you're still in touch with that experience. I often suggest that we journal during that time because a lot of profound insight can come out if we just pick up our pen and paper and write from that state of vyutana, of rising out of meditation. What Kshema Raja says about this transitional state is that if we can feel into it and spend a few minutes cultivating it or collecting it. One of my teachers used to say, after meditation, collect the particles of ecstasy and take them with you. Now, not every meditation is ecstatic. Most of us, as we spend more time in meditation, begin to recognize the particular flavor of peace or stillness or energy that is characteristic of it. And then we see if we can look out at the world in front of us. And remember, you're still sitting. You know, so look at whatever is in front of you with a part of your awareness inside your meditative state. And just notice how the sensory experience appears to you at those moments. One of my really favorite recent post-meditation experiences happens when there's a particular goddess chant I do every day. And very often after I've done it, I sit for a few minutes, I'll open my eyes, and it actually does feel as though everything in front of me is a form of the goddess. I know that many of you have such an experience. And what he says about this practice in his commentary is that when we meditate and touch our core, and he is admittedly specifically talking about the fairly deep state of meditation where you enter the madhya, where where actually the meditative state emerges. We don't always know it's emerged, strangely enough, but we want to have had real contact with awareness itself. And what happens every time you touch your own center, the space of awareness, even for 10 seconds, a samskara is created, an impression. Now, and remember, if you remember, you know, the findings of the fairly recent scientific recognition of neuroplasticity, the capacity of the brain and the neuronal connections to actually change, to form new patterns. This is what he's saying. He's saying that the samskaras of samadhi, or for that matter, the samskaras of mantra practice, the samskaras of awareness, the samskaras of touching into the heart space, are stored in your nervous system, just the way the old wounds are stored. And, of course, it's a lot more, how shall I say, it advances the cause of self-realization more deeply to have samadhi samskaras or mantra samskaras stored in your consciousness. And what Kshema says is that as you accumulate more and more impressions of awakened states or loving states or centered states or spacious states, they begin to become more and more available to us. My guru was once asked, I've quoted this before in this class, but I'm coming back to it because I do think it's a profound unpacking of this sutra. He was asked, can you describe your state? And he said, my state is one where I go beyond the mind and senses and swim in the ocean of bliss. Then he said, sometimes I come out of that state, but I always know how to get back to it. And this is what this practice is describing. You come out, you know, the experience of what Kshema is calling samadhi, of deep immersion in the field of your own awareness, is an interior state. You know, it's something that we need to meditate, most of us, in order to find. It doesn't necessarily occur for us when we're walking around, even if we're remembering to do self-inquiry or stay in the heart or repeat the mantra. It's obviously is kindled most strongly when we're sitting and we're turned inside. At the same time, to know how to get back to it means that we can more and more get into that state with much less intensive meditation, sitting for much shorter times, and going deeper, faster. As I said earlier, this practice is most powerful when we've actually touched into the core of consciousness, into the madhya, when you have a felt sense of what it feels like to be in spacious presence. And very often the experience that he's talking about, the practice that he's talking about, will be just a practice. In other words, you'll take this time to hold inner presence and then open your eyes and see the world through that lens, thereby proving to yourself, hopefully in a way that really is strong for you, that your inner state does actually affect the way you experience the so-called external world. It's a very, very big deal to cultivate an internal meditative awareness and then deliberately and consciously see what it's like to look at the waking world with attention in that awareness, with the intention to perceive whatever arises, and this is what he's really saying, as an expression of the awareness, presence, and blissfulness that is your deepest consciousness. Of course, the great power of being on retreat, of doing a retreat practice, is because you actually can cultivate this waking awareness in a much deeper way for much more of the time during the day than if you have to get up and go to work or cook breakfast for your family. But however you do it and wherever you do it, it's going to train your consciousness. I'm just going to discuss a little bit Kshema's own explanation of these verses. He has this very beautiful, very poetic description of the way a true tantrika comes out of meditation. Here's what he says. The tantric yogi who has attained immersion in the center, meaning the madhya, in the post-meditative state as well, swaying blissfully as if drunk, with the afterglow of the sweet taste of samadhi, sees the mass of existent things dissolving into the sky of awareness like wisps of autumn cloud. So he's describing the actual experience of a deeply practiced yogi here. But it's one that is available for us, if not every day, certainly some of the time, as our practice goes deeper. So, and then he says, again and again, taking support of the inward turn, the inward attention, touching pure oneness with awareness through the method of inward turning samadhi. Eventually, there is no longer a post-meditative state. He has become one for whom samadhi is the one taste. He has become one with for whom samadhi is the one taste. I have been fascinated by this idea for, I would say, most of the last 40 years, because it's an experience that the great sages, the great siddhas of the non-dual tradition, describe pretty much in the same way, this experience that with your eyes open, you actually can see the world arising and dissolving inside the light of consciousness, the bliss of consciousness, the awareness that is your awareness. This is a crucial instruction, and there are aspects of it that is important to get, and it's very important to understand that your immersion in the madhya, your immersion in the center, is actually what I would call a felt experience. In other words, it's not something that you're doing with your intellect, which many of us, including me, I certainly can do it with my intellect. I can, you know, kind of take a position that awareness is seeing through my eyes and creating a universe around me that arises and emerges on its own. You know, and you can probably right now drop your stories, and why don't we all do that? Just take 10 seconds, drop your stories, drop your identification as Elizabeth or Christine or Fred or Sally, for that matter, and just let yourself be awareness. Just ask yourself, who am I really? And feel into what arises. And just for 10 seconds, be that. See if you can let it expand. See if you can look outward, as it were, through the eyes with some part of your attention tuned to awareness. Many of you can do that. It's not that unusual. First of all, we've been practicing it, and some of you have been practicing it for a long time. But here's the thing. There is a difference, and you know, I think those of you who've experienced the mudra opening know there is a difference between our capacity to poise ourselves in a more global 360-degree awareness, which is actually a beautiful thing to be able to do and a very powerful practice. But it's different than actually having had the center emerge from its hiding place and take over for a few minutes in meditation. So how do you know that you've entered the center in the way that Kshema is talking about? And this is a question that I'm going to ask you to contemplate during the week to come and maybe discuss with your partner. How do you know that you've entered the mudra? And, you know, entering the mudra is hard to describe, but there are a few signs. One is that you feel as though you've been taken over by a kind of rising stillness, which pulses, it sort of pushes thoughts to the side. It's not like your mind becomes thought-free all the time, but the thoughts are clearly froth because this deeper presence, this deeper stillness, peacefulness, openness, witnessing quality has arisen. And inside that stillness, as we mentioned earlier, there is a kind of a pulsation, a feeling of Shakti, which may be, you may experience it as blissfulness, as love, or simply as a heightened sense of aliveness. This is an important piece because the samadhi described by Kshema and the tantrikas is actually somewhat different. We tantrikas say it's beyond the samadhi as described in classical Patanjali Yoga, where, you know, at least according to the texts, samadhi is the experience of immersion in stillness, in awareness, without any sense of objects. In the samadhi of yoga, I think we can fairly say at least the way it's described. Obviously, I don't have the right to speak for everyone's experience of it, but in the way the classical yogic samadhi is described, the body doesn't move, the mind doesn't move, you're absolutely still. One of the great statements about it is you're like a golden pillar, immovable. And that is, you know, a extremely high state. But in the tantric samavesha, the tantric samadhi, there is always a sense of pulsation. There's always a sense of blissfulness. And one of the words that Kshema uses, interestingly enough, to describe this experience is gurini, G-U-R-N-I, which means rolling or swaying, like, you know, as though you were intoxicated, as though you were drunk. And in the tantric traditions, and also in some of the Western devotional traditions, like the Hasidic meditation, that states of intense inward focus, I don't think the Hasid do so much inward focus, they're more about prayer and chanting and dancing. But in any case, their gatherings are often filled with movement. And the tantric sages, and if you're meditating in a room full of people who, you know, who have been received a tantric initiation and are doing these kind of practices, you'll often see that everybody in the room is kind of gently swaying. And according to Abhinavagupta, Kshema's guru, that swaying occurs in tantrikas even after they are deeply realized. So in other words, what he's saying here is that Shakti's never still, even when we're completely immersed in stillness, even when the body isn't moving, there is this pulsation going on inside our consciousness. And, you know, in this state, it's said that that there is the emergence, the coming forth of the underlying fourth state. There's the, you know, in the descriptions of the human being in both Tantra and Advaita Vedanta, they talk about four states of consciousness: waking, dream, and deep sleep, the ordinary states, and this other state, which is called Turiya, meaning the fourth, because it's not an ordinary state of consciousness. It emerges, and when it emerges, it actually devours or dissolves the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. So it, so that state, the emergence of Turiya, or the emergence of the Madhya, the coming forth of the Madhya, is the arising of what's also often called the meditative state. And as I said, it's usually an indrawn state, but many people experience it. Many people have their first experiences of Turiya when they're walking down the street. Or in my case, I was playing a game of hide and seek. I was at the age of 10 with a bunch of friends, you know, kids up the block. And this experience of utter relaxation, contentment, and spaciousness arose along with a natural feeling of underlying presence that was completely beyond Sally as I identified with her, and yet was the most intimate thing I'd ever experienced. Many of you have had such an arising, either in meditation or out of meditation. And the fourth state, the Turiya state, actually can be experienced as the source, as your personal source of all of the states that make up your life. So, in other words, your deep sleep state, your dream state, and your waking state are, in fact, always arising from Turiya, which is Chitti Shakti, which is your source. And what Kshema Raja is talking about is learning how to establish yourself in Turiya and then allow that indrawn state to begin to infuse your waking consciousness. So in an advanced practice, you begin by sitting long enough for this state to emerge. And as you know, it's not something we make happen because we already are that. That's one of the great truisms of the non-dual traditions. You sit long enough for the clouds and obscurations of ordinary agitation to settle, kind of like letting the foam on the top of a glass of beer to settle so that the golden liquid, which is the Turiya state beneath, can emerge. And again, in this experience of emergent Turiya, there will be a moment when you naturally come out of meditation. That's, you know, a not always understood fact about natural meditation is that Shakti turns within, but Shakti also will naturally turn back outside. This moving back from inward to outer focus, that is, it's, you know, it's called expansion, contraction, or in Sanskrit, unmesha, nimesha. The power in Shakti turns inward towards the source and often reveals the source, or sometimes just takes us into deep sleep. But then Shakti moves outward to express herself as what we experience in our day-to-day life. No matter how much you might want to sit in meditation all day long, and some of us do find that impulse in ourselves, Shakti is always going to bring you out. And when she brings you out, you have the opportunity to practice looking at the world through the remnants of your indrawn samadhi state and of infusing your connection with awareness into all of your thoughts and perceptions. Let's take a slightly longer time to practice. Close your eyes. And this time we're going to do it in a very simple way, feeling that with the inhalation, the breath flows in through the entire front of the body, and flows into the heart, into the center behind the breastbone. And that with the exhalation, have the feeling that the exhaled breath flows through the back of the heart and actually opens your back body so that you begin to become aware of a spaciousness that actually supports you from behind. So the inhalation flows in through the front of the body into the heart center. You're actually letting yourself center in the inner body, ground in the inner body. And then with the exhalation, see if you can feel the breath gently and softly opening the back of the heart so that your attention flows behind the body and you begin to tune into a spaciousness that is an awareness, has a sense of presence in it. We could call it the big heart. I like to call it goddess, but not a goddess with a form, but goddess as a loving holding presence. So just keep letting the breath cultivate this sense of opening through the inner body, through the heart, and then opening through the back body, through the energy behind the body. Now keeping your attention on the breath, on the felt sense of the breath, and on the felt sense of the space within the heart and behind the heart. Become aware of the awareness that knows this is happening, that knows you're meditating. Become aware of the awareness that's meditating on you. Now, as you open your eyes, look out at the world with the recognition, everything I see, hear, taste, smell, and touch is expanding from my own awareness. This world I experience with my senses is coming from inside me. Just see how long you can feel the effect of that intention to experience the world flowing from inside your awareness and being held inside your awareness. And then close your eyes. Let your attention flow with the breath into the heart. Be aware of the heart expanding backwards. As you meditatively follow the breath, the exhalation, be aware of your own awareness. And open your eyes, noticing how this multidimensional movie, which is visual, which is tactile, which has sound, just unfolds. So I'm going to stop talking and let you flow with this practice, turning in, sitting for a moment or two, aware of your heart, aware of awareness. And then when you're ready, opening your eyes with the intention to catch the fact, to catch the truth. That what appears as an external world is actually appearing within your awareness. Just play with that. Shakti Sankocha Vikasha, turning inside and recognizing that the inside is manifesting the outside when the eyes open. So this practice of turning within, catching the flow of awareness inwardly, and then turning outside, having dyed your attention, dyed your perception, D-Y-E-D as in colored, with your taste of pure awareness or your taste of the heart, we're all going to find it inside ourselves in our own way tonight. But as we, what we're really doing is integrating our open-eyed, outward-looking state with our inner state. And those of you who, you know, do a lot of practice know that this is kind of pretty much the fundamental gesture of sadhana once we've managed to open up the meditative space. Then the idea is to bring the awareness with us into the open-eyed space state, but to do it in a way that is not trying to fix ourselves in meditative consciousness. When I was first on this journey, I would have these inner experiences and I would feel very centered. And then I would say to myself, well, if I can only hold on to this feeling of centeredness while I'm in that tough meeting or, you know, when I'm having that difficult conversation. So I would try to kind of rigidly keep my awareness inside. And I would do it very often by visualizing something, the heart lotus often. And then it would be impossible to have a natural conversation because so much of my attention would be focused on trying to maintain inner focus as well as seeing everything around me as part of myself. So you don't want to do this practice in such a way that it becomes, you know, a problem in your daily life. You want to just do it in the first moments as you come out of meditation and then bring yourself back to it during the day. So in Sutra 20, Kshema is describing the fruits of this sadhana, which is essentially, he's describing self-realization in the recognition tradition. So I'm just going to say the English, mainly because the Sanskrit verse is so long. Oh, well, I'll say it. Tada prakashanandasara. Prakashanandasara is a really great word. It means the light and bliss, the essence of light and bliss. So tada prakasha ananda sara maha mantra viriyatmaka purna hanta vashat sada sarva sarga samhara kari nija samvit devata chakreshwarata prapsir bhavatiti shivam. Bhavat iti shivam. Those are the last words of the text. Iti shivam means it's all God. So that's where we're coming. And here's the English. Then because of immersion in the fully expanded I sense, the aham, which is in essence light and bliss, and is the source of the power of all mantras, one attains the state of being the master of the circles of Shakti, the powers of awareness, who are constantly engaged in the emanation and reabsorption of all things. All this is God. So there's a lot in this sutra. We're not going to unpack all of it tonight. You're going to get to unpack some of it in the week to come. So what's he saying? First of all, he is talking about the result of the experiment that we are doing that he describes in Sutra 19, where we feel into the center and then learn to cultivate the experience of the center with our open eyes. And he's also talking about what happens when this cultivation becomes natural, when it becomes a nityodita samadhi, a continually arising samadhi. So nityodita, the continual arising experience of being so immersed in the interior sense of awareness that you can experience the world as being permeated by the self. Eternally arising samadhi, very attractive state. In this verse, he uses a different word, purana hanta. Purana means fullness, and hanta means expansion of the self, self-expansion. In other words, what he's talking about is the recognition that your I, the most intimate part of yourself, contains all that is. And he describes this fully expanded I in his commentary on his own commentary in this verse as being one with the goddess awareness. In other words, when your awareness expands, it becomes absolutely clear that your awareness is goddess's awareness, is divine awareness. This is the realization that your most intimate self is no longer covered by your identity confusion, but has become aware of the fact that it is goddess herself who is appearing as you. And again, this is not an egoistic awareness. It comes to you when ego dissolves, when you are actually capable of experiencing the expansion of consciousness and not believing that it's just happening to you. In other words, not believing that it's you personally who is that expanded awareness. And in that realization, one of the great sages, by the way, of my tradition, Nyaneshwar Maharaj, puts it like this. He describes his own experience. He says, by trying to see Shiva and Shakti, I and my vision disappeared. When my ego dissolved, I became Shiva and Shakti. So in other words, in this expansion, your sense of being a limited self can only dissolve. And again, this is something that we work our way into, because if it happens too quickly, or, you know, which it has for many of us, I've had a few quick experiences of it myself, but when it happens too quickly, we can't really integrate it, and we often get scared. So one of the reasons that we just keep returning again and again and again to this cultivation is so that we can actually begin to have an integrated experience of consciousness seeing through our eyes, and eventually realize that it isn't Sally's consciousness. It's not Elizabeth's consciousness. It's not Wolf's consciousness. It's Chitti. It's Shiva who's seeing through your eyes. And he goes into a very detailed experience of what that means. But one of the things he says immediately is that this expansion is a fusion of awareness and delight. It's a state of wonder. It's a state of complete wonder, delighted wonder, at realizing that the self, which has been making you think that you're a person confined to this body and living in a world in which everything is outside you, it's like you suddenly are able to see, oh my God, all this is manifesting inside Godness. The great 19th century Indian master Ramakrishna Paramahansa, who was a great enlightened tantrika, used to tell a story about a holy man he knew who lived on the banks of the Ganga in Calcutta and who'd spend the entire day just going, oh my God, oh my God. He'd look at the river and the boats and the people and he'd exclaim, oh mother, how have you become all this? Oh ma, how have you become all this? What a wonder, what a miracle this world is. Oh ma, how did you do it? How did you become all this? And, you know, it's really a great question. How does this happen? You know, how does this sparkling diversity manifest? Does she know how she does it? Or does it just pour out of her? You know, the way I know I myself as a writer have this experience quite often that my fingers are doing the writing. My mind is not writing. It's happening through my body. And I think that many people who do creative work have this experience at times. You're not figuring it out. It's just happening. There's no mental process involved. It's an outflow of creative power. And in fact, what the experience that he's talking about here is of actually seeing that the world that you feel to be dense and diverse is actually a continual flow of patterns of energy of which your organized embodiment is a particular node, you know, that you are a pattern of energy interacting with other patterns of energy in a constantly undulating flow. And that flow is not under your individual control. It's under her control, which is, of course, one of the reasons that most of the great traditions suggest that a really good way to live your life is to recognize that you are not the doer of your life. So this self-organizing capacity of the world, which is actually Chitti's organization, is a natural expression of her supreme intelligence, which is the source of our mental operations, including our ego, but which is completely untouched by our mental operations, that somehow simultaneously she can flow in absolute delight and vastness through this individual being, and this individual being will completely believe that she, me, Sally, or you, Loring, are creating your own thoughts, that you're making the decision to move your arm, even though biologists are now discovering that the decision to move the arm takes place in the body before the mind even has the chance to make a decision. So everything that we're discovering about how action and thinking take place inside our body-mind is that it really is not under our conscious control. Much of what we experience as my life is simply a spontaneous outflowing that is determined by not by our own choice, but by a deeper biological imperative, which Kshema Raja will tell you is the will of Goddess. So the one who's seeing through your eyes is her. The one who's thinking your thoughts is her. And it's a very important thing to keep in mind, because one of the rookie mistakes that we make when we start really imbibing non-dual awareness is to identify our personal consciousness with the great consciousness and therefore own the realizations that occur to us. I think most of us have done it. My favorite kind of hilarious story about this is something that an old friend of mine, one of my former Swami colleagues, told me once. When he had his initial awakening, and it was a very big opening into pure awareness, and he really saw, much as Kshema is saying, that the world he sees and tastes and smells is not separate from him, and that in fact he saw it's all coming from within him. He didn't really have a lot of experience. He had been brought up in a mystic in a Christian tradition, and though he understood that there are many mystics in the Christian tradition, the experience that he was having seemed to him like the kind of experience that could only happen to Jesus. So he immediately began to identify himself with Jesus, and he did that classic, deluded thing of thinking, "Oh my God, I'm Jesus, I'm the incarnation of Jesus." He fortunately managed to keep it to himself. He realized that nobody would much understand, and eventually he got that what he was experiencing was not a sign that he had become an avatar, but actually a normal human experience of radical awakening, one that is available to anyone. Let's just take a breath or two. Kshema really is saying here that as individual perceivers, we are rays, like rays of the sun that emanate from the true perceiver, the ultimate perceiver. We're unique rays. In other words, this ray of consciousness that's Christine has a unique expression, the ray of consciousness that Sally has a unique expression. So it's not one big mush, but nonetheless, we're rays. We're not the sun. We're nodes of the flow of Chitti's Shakti. We are not as individuals the origin of it. That one great consciousness which sees and thinks and tastes through us is us, but not in the way we normally think we are. And at this point in the text, Kshema really does begin to speak from a level of consciousness beyond the mind. It makes sense, we can make it make sense intellectually, of course, because we're sophisticated and educated, but it makes most sense to us when we tune into our own awareness. So as I'm speaking, just see if you can take the backward step. Recognize the capacity for awareness, the knowingness. And see if you can make this slight shift from identifying with the body-mind to identifying with awareness. One of my favorite ways of recognizing this presence is to ask yourself, what is it that's meditating on my life? There's something that's present to your life. It's greater than your life, and yet intimately a part of you. And recognize that as you identify with awareness, and I know it's very subtle, you can kind of, this is how I do it. I feel myself moving kind of behind the body, including the body in this overall sense of awareness. And once I've felt into the knowingness, I bring my attention into the body. And feel the inhalation and exhalation move into the lungs, move into the chest, into the legs, recognizing that it's awareness that's able to feel sensations in the body. To recognize that we are adapted to make sense of all the different rays of light and energy that flow in particular patterns that our brain and nervous system sorts as table, tree, arm, underlying this experience of table, tree, arm is an endless flow of light and energy that's moving in particular patterns, particular waveforms, which the brain and nervous system organize into an image that feels distinct, which we can then interact with. And obviously, because we're human beings and we have the same neurophysiological adaptation mechanism in our nervous system, we have a shared agreement on what an oak tree looks and feels like, or what this particular oak tree or this particular pair of scissors looks and feels like. So one of the very beautiful teachings that Kshema gives in this sutra is the teaching that when you become centered inside the madhya, when you have experienced and are able to experience your I consciousness, your awareness, which remember is Shiva's awareness, Shakti's awareness, when you're able to experience awareness as fully expanded, such that you actually can feel the world as yourself, you become what Kshema calls, what Tantra calls, the lord of the wheel of energies. You become the master of the experience of your mind and senses manifesting the world. It's as though you're sitting in the center of a mandala. And what you see, what you taste, what you smell, what you perceive is flowing around you, being offered to you. But your experience of yourself is that you're in this utterly free and expanded I awareness. An awareness of pure being that is filled with bliss and freedom, that is literally the master, the mistress, the lord, the lady, the center. You are that. Everything arises from you and within you. And again, this is something that the great sages have described again and again and again. And in his commentary on this verse, Kshema traces the experience of the one perceiver backwards from awareness of awareness, which is where we start, to being centered in the madhya, which is a deeper experience of that. And as the mudra expands, we can become aware that what it is that's seeing through our eyes and senses is what he calls Sriman Mahadev, the great Lord whose nature encompasses the great lady. So the fusion of Shiva and Shakti, this experience of I am the source of all. I am the source of all. Again, not limited me, the big me, the big I, Purna Hanta. One of the really accessible experiences of this, and I know that almost all of you, if not all of you, have had this experience at one time or another, is to be able to look into the eyes of another person and recognize the spark of consciousness in their eyes and realize that it's not different than yours. And I feel that being able to recognize consciousness in another person is actually one of the significant signs of awakening and moments of awakening that most of us can experience fairly early in our practice journey. And you may have had that experience in partner work or in group work. It's one of the main reasons why practicing with others, why satsang is so fruitful. Because when we practice, when we meditate in a group or when we meditate with another person, the contraction of consciousness, which ordinarily feels like it's only inside our body, actually does begin to expand very naturally. And if we can let ourselves notice it, if you can let yourself notice how your awareness tends to expand in this class or when you're listening to the download of the class or when you're sitting live in a group, it's of course very strong when you're sitting live in a group and everyone is really interiorly focused. Or when you're doing a partner practice and looking into someone else's eyes, you do start to see how one single ray of consciousness is looking through their eyes and through your eyes. So connecting on that level to another being is a first step for many people in beginning to recognize that whatever we experience is being experienced by one awareness. So let us just take another couple of minutes to practice our Shakti Sankocha Vikasha meditation. Remember, Shakti Sankocha Vikasha means drawing in, contracting, and then spreading out, expanding the Shakti, the power inherent in awareness, the power that gets kindled and rekindled every time awareness turns back into itself in this act of self-reflection that is one of the fundamental gestures of Shakti. Remember, Chitti Shakti is always moving back and forth between internal awareness, between being focused back on herself and then expanding out to become the multiplicity. So she does this constantly, and she does it through our perceptions. She pulls inside, finds the power, her own power, her inmost nature, and then fully potentized by contact with herself in that pure essential form, she pours out into the universe. Just begin now by grounding the posture again, feeling the sits bones and the triangle between the pubic bone and the sits bones. Align the crown of your head with the inner side of the triangle. And just for a moment, feel the presence of the central channel as a pillar of energy or simply vibration that extends from the center of the triangle up through the lower belly, just inside the spinal column. Feel it as the center that flows up the center body, up through the chest, through the throat, through the head. Feel that this channel, this inner channel, is your core. It's the heart of you. The breath is flowing through the crown, sweeping gently down the channel as far down as is natural and easy, then gently rising up with the exhalation. Notice how as you center on the breath, feeling that the breath flows down from above, flows through the crown, flows down from the crown to the center of the head, through the throat and into the heart, and down the channel, down towards the triangle. Don't worry about whether you get it or not. Just follow the breath flowing in through the crown and down towards the base, and flowing up with the exhalation. Noticing how as you follow the inhalation and exhalation, that your attention will tend to settle into the core. Your attention will become more and more indrawn. And you might feel that as thoughts come up, as feelings come up, as sensations come up, that they are adornments inside that current of energy that's the central channel. You're just present with the breath, the flow in and down, and out and up. One of the ways the central channel is described in some of the tantric texts is as the golden pillar that supports the three worlds. The center of consciousness out of which your waking, dream, and deep sleep states arise. How deeply can you immerse your attention in the central channel? And is it possible to allow the breath to flow your attention inward and yet to relax your whole body? To recognize how the prana shakti moving through the inhalation and exhalation is utterly imbued and empowered by chitti shakti, who is its source. And to recognize how your own breath is gently through the kinesthetic power of feeling, because the breath is a kinesthetic process, it's gently opening your sense of the channel, of the presence of the Madhya Nadi in the middle of the body. Keeping your awareness of the breath and your sense of the channel anchor yourself in the channel. And then imagine, again, your eyes are still closed. Ask the question, what is it that's aware of all this? Keeping your eyes closed for the moment, just have the sense of throwing your sense of hearing, your sense of touch outward so that you get a felt sense that everything that you can sense around you is a part of your awareness. And then open your eyes and allow the visual field to be experienced from this place of inner centeredness. Close your eyes again, feeling as though when you close your eyes, you pull the whole exterior inside and you fold your attention into the central channel and follow the breath. Let your eyes fall open. Have the intention to recognize all this that I experience through my senses is permeated with awareness, is an expression of this one awareness. And then close your eyes again and take it back inside and just see if you can open and close your eyes a couple more times as you center yourself again and again in the central channel. So this is the tantric realization. You cultivate the core, the center again and again through meditation. And over time, instead of being something that you're trying to find, it becomes a natural expansion. It begins to emerge. And you do begin to realize that inside this central channel, this Ashumna Nadi, inside the lotus in the heart, inside the space between breaths, inside the space behind thoughts, in all these places where the madhya can expand, one single awareness is being revealed, which is both the deepest part of you and utterly beyond you. And you experience this again and again and again until it becomes your place of refuge, a place you literally take refuge in. And in the meantime, you go about your life. You fulfill your karmas. You learn what you learn. You love and you fight and you work and you succeed and you fail and you worry and you relax. You express yourself. You grow up psychologically and socially. You make mistakes. You uncover old traumas. Your beliefs keep changing. Chitti manifests through all these personal struggles and triumphs. But you keep as your priority the constant returning to an expansion of the center of your core of consciousness, becoming stable there as you take refuge again and again until it becomes a default mode for you. And the samskaras of inner immersion become stronger and stronger and stronger. And the samskaras of your intention to recognize that one great consciousness is living as you and through you, creating the world for you. That intention begins to become more and more at the center of your life. And eventually, it becomes a more and more normal experience to realize that all this is Shiva Shakti, Iti Shiva, all this is God. And at that point, your process of introversion and extroversion begins to be revealed as your personal experience of the fivefold act, like it says in Sutra 10 and 11. And then you realize that though there is no you in the ordinary sense of the word, there is only Shiva Shakti. That what you are is that. And at this point, you can really say, Iti Shiva, it's all God. My guru used to say, God forgets God, God loses God, God looks for God, and God finds God. It is God who questions and God who answers. So let me read to you as we come to bring this class to a close a statement that Kshemaraja makes at the very end of the text. It's the epilogue of the Pratyabhijna Hridayam. It's really the promise. It's the reason he wrote the text. He says, people who are bound at every moment by the shackles of identification with the body, with the energy body, with the experience of pleasure, pain, and so on, do not recognize which is right here, their own divine awareness, thick with the joy of perfect wholeness. But one who through this teaching sees the universe all around him, all around her, as nothing more than a mass of foam on the surface of the nectarian ocean of awareness, that person is said to be Shiva Shakti made fully manifest. Iti Shivam, All this is God. Srimad Raja's teacher, Abhinavagupta, describes how awareness constantly moves back into itself and then flows out as the world, and how this experience is always new, always the cause of wonder. And so the real fruit of the Pratyabhijna Hridayam, of our practice, and of our immersion in this teaching, is to kindle more and more deeply this capacity for wonder and joy that underlies the stories that we make up about who we are and about what our life is, that underlies the illusions created by the nervous system. So that even if we're not seeing chitti everywhere, because of our intention to immerse ourselves in her, we can find her footprints in every moment that we look at the world or feel into the world and recognize what a freaking miracle it is that all this is playing as a physical universe and an interior universe, and that we have the capacity to know it for what it is and to know ourselves for what we are. So, iti Shivam. The word Shiva means God, and it also means blessing. So, this is his conclusion. It's all Shiva. It's all God. It's all blessing. So this is our last class. You are going to be getting homework and questions. The listserv will be open for another 2 weeks. I deeply hope that you'll share with each other and discuss with each other and continue this unfolding to the degree that you're able. We will be doing a class on the Shiva Sutras, another great text of this tradition, probably sometime starting in the late summer or early fall. And I'm also going to be teaching a goddess class, which will not be that different from the goddess class that some of you have taken with me, but which I'm offering for the sake of those who haven't studied it or who want to go more deeply into it. And that will be beginning in April. So again, please stay in touch. Please enjoy your practice. Please share your insights. I love you all so much. I'm so grateful to be part of this Sangham. Namaste. Iti Shivam.